I think when we look at kind of the news and just looking at history, a lot of times we see these things before. I mean, going back to the protests that we've seen in the past, it's so great to kind of draw from that history to really contextualize the moment. So being able to just kind of resurface our archival images has been really helpful, I think, in our reporting.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Media Voices. We're the Media Focus podcast that brings you all the news and the views from the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Keto Liston.
Very cheery.
Yeah.
And that extract you just heard is from Adriana Lacey, who is the audience engagement editor at the LA Times. So she launched a dedicated Instagram account for the LA Times' archival photos last year. So we talked about where those images are sourced from and what the response has been, and also how they've used historical images of protests to add context to the events of the past few weeks. She did also talk about the LA Times' wider social media strategy and why it's so important to have that direct connection to readers. So do stay tuned for that.
And before we crack on, we want to say a thousand thank yous to everyone who's bought us a coffee using our... Is it coffee or Ko-Fi? What do we decide on that?
I think it's coffee.
I think it's Ko-Fi. It's okay. So confusing when you first said to use coffee. And I was like,
more sense.
Thank you so much, and do stick around to the end because we're going to be doing individual shout-outs to every single one of you. Well, as we mentioned at the start, this is going to be a cheerier episode than the last two. I mean, that's not difficult. The bar is set, you know, the bar is subterranean at this point, but we're going to be looking at green shoots of recovery for publishing coming out of the back end of the COVID-19 crisis. We're not out of the woods yet, but we can sort of see the road again from here.
Yeah, so this was a story in Press Gazette this week about Wired, who are forecasting growth of 10% this year after seeing a huge appetite from readers and advertisers during the pandemic. Now, that part of it is not exclusive to Wired. I know, like, we've talked many times about publishers seeing record traffic over the past 2 weeks. But what was really, really interesting about this piece and the way Wired have done it is that they've actually managed to cash in on that traffic. Mm. And they've managed to kind of keep, like, ad revenues drop, but they've managed to keep it kind of a little bit steady.
So what are they attributing it to?
Well, the first thing is that they said that the past few years they've actually done this big repositioning of the brand. So it's not just, you know, Wired deals with gadgets. They've said, you know, we're going to cover science, tech, politics, business, culture. And they say that they're in competition with Bloomberg and The Economist and places like that.
See, I believe that. I do believe that because it's almost become a culture site as much as it is a tech site.
Well, okay, so as an old guy, that's exactly how Wired started. Mm. That was where Wired started. It was all about internet culture. It was about digital culture.
It's not just that. It was really early January when they saw what was coming. I'm obviously, they couldn't predict quite how bad it would be, but they shuffled a load of their editorial budget to science, politics and business because they said, well, people are going to want to read more about those topics as the crisis developed, which meant that in March, they managed to triple their traffic year on year, which is really, really impressive.
Yeah, I'm looking at that word tripled and it just seems completely alien to me.
The way I thought that was interesting they described as they had a what's next focused rather than a focus on what's happening now.
So that also really helped their events because they, like everybody, they had to postpone their huge like Wired Health event. They've got another big event coming up in June they've had to postpone. But instead they broke it all down and they said, right, we're going to do all these webinars and roundtables and kind of practical things based on what happens next. You know, look 6 months, 12 months down the line, what do we do? Which meant that when the advertisers were like, oh, so what's happening about these events? They were like, oh, we'll still keep your money, but instead, we're going to funnel it to these smaller events, which we've still got loads of interest in. They said they managed to retain most of the spend from Wired Health by just kind of funneling it into these smaller events, and advertisers have stuck with it. Yeah,
I mean, if you look at their, if you look at the kind of priorities in terms of their revenue, it's ads first, then events, then magazines. Mm-hmm. So I think they've definitely had a kind of refocus on where the money was.
Yeah, and they say at the end of the interview that the whole point of diversification is that if one or two or three things are challenged, you can still focus on growing the rest, which is like that's the whole point.
Well, somebody else is doing really well. In the UK, The Telegraph has actually joined The Spectator, and it's going to pay back the government's furlough money. So I think it was, 2 weeks ago, The Spectator announced that they were going to pay back all the money that the government had given them to cover staff costs during furlough. And now The Telegraph has joined them because of... they've remained profitable during these worst 3 months of what must have been recent memory for The Telegraph.
These brands, Spectator and The Telegraph, what's the point they're trying to make by giving this money back? I don't know. It confuses me a little bit.
Do you think it's a victory lap?
I don't know. Something makes me a little bit uncomfortable about it.
I think one of the things that actually I also really liked about this story is that so they had to furlough 19 non-editorial staff, which is fair enough. You know, they've got people working on events and ads and stuff. And they had to put quite a few people on four-day weeks, and like I think it was there to reduce pay down to like 80 or 90%. But they've actually said now, because they've managed to return all this money and because of the profitability, they've brought all the staff back to the five-day week. And anybody that had pay cuts in May is going to be compensated for those lost earnings.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah. So yeah, they're basically saying, you know, if anybody's lost out because of this, you will get it back. You will get the money back.
We
just
Christ.
Had to tighten belts for a month or two, which is like that's really good. They didn't have to, but it's a good thing to do.
No, that is good.
This story just confuses me. It's great, and I'm so glad that these people that lost money are getting that back. Rapacious capitalism doesn't get back money. It confuses me.
I'm just resetting. I don't know if you can hear this. I'm just resetting the sign. It has now been 0 days since Peter said rapacious capitalism.
You can cut this if you want. I'm just confused by it.
All right. But, I mean, those subscription numbers are pretty good. They still have a way to go before they reach their target of 1 million paying subscribers. But...
well, they're halfway there now, aren't they? Okay, so talking of subscription success, there is a subscription impact report from Zuora, who are a software company that actually do subscription software as part of their offering. So they've actually found that businesses that rely on subscription revenues are, shockingly enough, showing resilience. So they've surveyed a number of publishers and found that 50% of them are growing as fast as they were before the pandemic. And actually one in five of those are then showing accelerated growth of more than 25%. So, I mean, there's nothing negative we can say about this, right? Except the one in five people that aren't growing throughout the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can think of something if you want. How long we've got?
I mean, the thing with subscriptions is the lag time on them. So a lot of the resilience for subscriptions is kind of a bit of like a false metric, because people will still have paid for their subscriptions up front. But that growth suggests that, no, there is genuine appetite among audiences to support subscription products, you know, whether that's because they offer them information that they need or they offer them, I don't know, diversion from this hellscape that we found ourselves in.
I mean, that's where I'd have thought a lot of the tests for the retention will come this time next year when people aren't bored.
Yeah.
I also think that growth, I mean, fingers what's crossed. Interesting about this is a growth of more than 25%. That's a great number.
Yeah.
You know, just to say that people are growing as fast as they were before the pandemic, who cares? But if there's almost 20% growing faster and that, you know, more than 25%, that's amazing. That's really good.
You know, what's interesting as well is that very few of the subscription places I've seen have actually changed their messaging in the way that B2C products have.
Yeah.
That's it's almost true. Like this is the proof point for the product itself rather than the marketing of it.
I think that's true. Because, you know, The Guardian's a great example. They don't...
Talking of which, that is an excellent segue. Yeah.
Well, it's just the same while you're here message, isn't it? And, you know, it's obviously working because The Guardian has gained 200,000 new supporters during the pandemic.
Now, this is interesting, though, because it is effectively 50-50 now in terms of who's taking out that recurring option versus how many people are making one-off contributions.
Well, and they again, it comes back to this thing with, I think, the success at The Telegraph, the success at The Spectator, the success at The Guardian, the success at Wired. These are all premium, you know, whether you agree with the politics or you don't agree with the politics, they're all premium brands, a brand that you will trust inside a certain community. That's the story here, I think.
Well, it got 2.2 billion page views in March, so that's what
I can't quite get my head around that.
Yeah, but there's always a you know, shitty lining to every cloud. So it's still projecting this £20 million loss in revenue over the next 6 months due to loss of ad revenue and loss of newsstand sales.
Yeah, so, I mean, however cheery we are trying to be in this episode, there's still a shit show out there.
I think this is where this quote, my favourite quote from a publishing executive in Digiday came in. Everything is still dreadful, but it's trending in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yay!
Can I drop in my literal green shoot this time?
Yeah.
Okay, so this was a fun story. Bloomberg have actually launched a new print magazine last week called Bloomberg Green. So this is a new quarterly magazine focused on climate change solutions. And this is actually off the back of a community they've built through email newsletters. So this is a good story, and it's a literal green shoot, so...
Why don't they call it Greenberg?
Green Bloom?
Green Bloom.
Green Bloom. We've That's fixed much your magazine, better, yeah. guys.
Fixed it.
Green Bloom.
Yeah, we talk about Thomas Bechdel a lot. Did you see that piece that was about, you know, now is the time to launch a print magazine that
yeah.
he did?
Yeah, yeah, I almost subscribed to Bechdel Plus just because of it. In fact, right, I'm going to, you know what, I'm going to subscribe.
Well, it made me dig out my flat plan and all the pitch documents I had for the magazine. Yeah. Just because there's been that reset. Why am I saying this? I'll give people ideas.
Well, you can just bleep out the topic.
But, you know, it's not just the kind of subscriptions that are showing promise, because the ad market's showing signs of recovery too. Now, the keyword there is recovery, because it has been a nightmare for ad-supported publishers over the last couple of months. But Esther, what have been some of those key stats?
Okay, so in April, and this is just digital display ad spending, not video and all the rest, total digital display ad spend in Europe was down 38% year on year. But in May, it was down just 25%.
Yes!
And June spending is estimated to be down just 16%. I think the key point from this is that actually it's bouncing back a little bit faster than people expected, so they're hoping that curve will shift up fairly quickly. But most of the growth seems to be coming from programmatic spend, which is returning, but direct deals are basically still lagging behind.
Yeah.
So I don't want to piss on the ad industry's chips.
However, is the word recession about to spring from your lips?
Recession, I think, is a given. But one of the things in that story is the guys are talking about the ad market basically tracking GDP.
Mm.
The government, or some government body, has just announced that GDP fell 20%. And project, which is the biggest fall in history,
yep.
and they're projecting possibly up to 35%. So if the ad market's tracking GDP, whoof. So after that cheery little roundup, we'll move on to news and brief. And you know, there was more proof this week that headlines actually do matter after last week's buildings matter bullshit. But there was a huge and pretty much universal backlash against the Sun. Again, after it tracked down J.K. Rowling's first husband, who she alleged abused her, and they ran this headline, which is just, I don't know, man. The headline was, "I slapped J.K. and I'm not sorry," and it's just like, guys, read the fucking room. You know, she was up for all sorts of criticism for a potentially or allegedly transphobic viewed.
No, not alleged. I don't want to
get into that. Okay, transphobic viewed. She certainly did not read the room herself with that. You know, whatever your view on that, putting her ex-husband up, who's not apologising for slapping her, is a headline. It's just ridiculous. They had some bullshit statement of...
Oh, I saw the statement that was like, oh, well, we criticised him in the story, and it was like, you still put him on the front page.
The response was, and actually I've seen this, I think, twice this week now, I'm afraid that our front page has been taken out of context. No, the front page is the context. You just f***ed up. And it was interesting to see how few of the Sun's usual supporters actually came out to defend this one.
It was the same bullshit when it came to the BBC and other people trying to describe people who were against Black Lives Matter protests. And the BBC just tied itself in knots with this. Some woman, like, having a go at Yorkshire Tea for backing Black Lives Matter, and the BBC described her as an anti-racism critic. Just unpack that. An anti-racism critic... It's a fucking racist.
Yeah.
Right?
I think there is a libel justification for that, though.
I'm sure. But there's got... Well, they've changed the headline now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Black Lives Matter critic, which is still a dick. But to describe these numpties as counter-protesters is just bullshit.
To be fair...
It's bullshit.
Yeah,
and
I think
that's everyone, from Sky News to BBC to the Evening Standard to Manchester Evening News to the National in Scotland, they're all taking this bullshit counter-protesters line. So there you go, there's my...
And breathe. Talking of Black Lives Matter protests,
mm-hmm.
Black Lives Matter content is actually the latest to be hit by keyword blocking from cautious advertisers. So keyword blocking basically means that publishers make no ad money on any news or content mentioning Black Lives Matter, which, as you can imagine, is quite a lot of it at the moment.
It seems counterintuitive. There was a piece of research out not too long ago that showed when a brand associates itself with something like that, it actually gets more cut through. the brands that only, you know, I don't even know. It just seems so cowardly to me that.
That's a cowardly bit is exactly right.
The next one is really fun, I think. So Twitter is testing a feature that calls you out for retweeting an article if you haven't actually read it. So, you know, the temptation is you scroll on through Twitter, you see something you agree with, you just smash that retweet button. And that has been, you know, blamed variously for, you know, contributing to the spread of misinformation and contributing to the spread of, you know, confirmation bias. So now Twitter is basically, as soon as you go to hit retweet, it comes up with a prompt that says, hey, you haven't read this, do you want to take a look? And you don't have to read it.
My point is it needs to label it. If you retweet it without reading it, it puts like a label of shame on you. Oh, and I would love that.
That would be absolutely fantastic.
So it's like, this retweet comes from somebody who hasn't actually read the article. We put a poll out and it suggested that actually 77% of you would actually stop and read the article if you saw this prompt, which that warmed my heart a little bit.
But do you know why that is? Because only good people listen to the Media Voices podcast.
Yeah, it is a bit of a self-selected audience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about self-selecting. George Osborne stepping down as editor of the Evening Standard to become the editor-in-chief.
In what sense is that stepping down?
Yeah, I don't know, that's a weird one, man. But it's okay, don't worry, guys, because Emily Sheffield is taking over the editor's role.
Well, I was going to say, thank God that the Standard has taken the long overdue step of distancing itself from the Tory party, with which it has troublingly close ties. So George Osborne, David Cameron's former chancellor, is stepping down in favour of Emily Sheffield, David Cameron's sister-in-law. So nice. Thank God that problem has gone away forever.
In other news, Dallas Morning News is trialling reporter-specific discount codes that give readers a free one-month trial in the name of supporting local journalism.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. Although I do worry it's going to give rise to a little bit of sort of quotas against for journalists about, you know, how many people can you get to subscribe. And after weeks of top editors resigning across the industry, Vogue editor Anna Winter, shockingly, is actually the latest in the firing line. She's had to send out a company memo apologising for not giving space to black people at Vogue and various discriminatory behaviours. So never thought I'd see the day.
Oh, I saw this. It's just nuts. Do you know, there's a study, Nikki Simpson talks about it a lot. There was more flamingos on the cover of mainstream magazines than there was people of colour.
What?
Yeah. It was exactly that. It was a couple of years ago because, yeah, there were more flamingos on the front covers of mainstream women's magazines than there were black people.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
You're fucking kidding me.
No, it's true.
Well, you know what? It's at least it's proven that the Black Lives Matter protests are actually having an effect and having an impact.
There's some cut through. I mean, you know,
and after we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago, Microsoft's decision to replace human journalists with robots has backfired immediately because its AI software illustrated a news story about racism with a photo of the wrong mixed race member of the girl group Little Mix.
Do you know what else is funny about this?
Go on.
It then kept syndicating stories about being rubbish.
Yeah.
They had to actually get human editors to intervene to stop it syndicating stories about it being racist.
The European Journalism Centre has launched the Freelance Journalism Assembly to support self-employed community with training, mentorship and events. And really, this is about bringing self-employed journalists together, and it's brilliant and we love them. Well done.
Yeah, that is a fantastic one. And frankly, at the moment, even if didn't want to join it because of, you know, the training and the stuff about financial management and actually pitching, I would just join because freelance journalists can drink like fish and I just want to go to the pub again so badly.
Boom.
This week I spoke to Adriana Lacey, who is the audience engagement editor at the LA Times. So I began by asking her what prompted the launch of a standalone account for their archival photos.
At the LA Times, we've always kind of found that our readers are really engaged with our archival work. So before the account existed, we shared a lot of archival content on our Classic Hollywood Facebook page, which kind of focuses on vintage films and TV shows with a lot of interest from there. And then we started just kind of experimenting, posting archival photos on our main Instagram account kind of once a week on Thursdays. And we saw a lot of success from there too and knew that a standalone account could be sustainable.
It's over 10,000 followers now, isn't it?
Yeah, right now we have about 12,000 followers. So it's been really successful, and we've been really seeing a lot more growth lately when we've been kind of resurfacing a lot of the protests and kind of riot footage that we have.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. What's behind the decision to post historical images of protests at a time like this? Like, does it add a different context to what's going on today?
Yeah, for sure. I think as an audience team, one thing at the LA Times, contextualizing our coverage has been something that's extremely important for us. So we've kind of been really intentional with the account and trying to really connect photos of the past to what's going on today. And we know that LA has a history of kind of these racial protests, and connecting kind of those past events to what's happening now has been really invaluable to helping our readers really understand the moment that's happening right now.
What's the response been like to that? I mean, hopefully good, but...
Yeah, the response has been great. A lot of our readers hadn't known a lot about some of the history of some of the protests and things that have happened in the past in LA and in LA County. So a lot of people are commenting saying, you know, wow, I've never heard of this before. This is really interesting. So I think it's just been really a great learning experience for a lot of our readers.
And where do you actually get those images from? Like, what's the process of kind of finding and deciding what to put up?
Yeah, so an estimated 4 million LA Times images from around 1918 to around 1990 are stored in the UCLA Special Collections Library. So we use a lot of those photos to populate the account. One great thing is that we don't think we'll have a shortage anytime soon. but in addition to that, we also have digitized a lot of our own photos in-house. So we're also resurfacing those photos as well. And what's really interesting about those photos is a lot of them haven't been published or seen by the public for decades. So they're really getting kind of a look at photos that they've never really seen before.
Do you think there's a value for publishers in maintaining archives like this and resurfacing content like this?
Absolutely. I think when we look at kind of the news and just looking at history, a lot of times we see these things before. I mean, going back to the protests that we've seen in the past, it's so great to kind of draw from that history to really contextualize the moment. So being able to just kind of resurface our archival images has been really helpful, I think, in our reporting. We've seen a lot of our reporters kind of make parallels between things like the Watts riots in 1992 and to the protests that are happening now. So it's been really great to see kind of our entire newsroom dig into our archives lately.
Do you write the captions for that as well, or is there additional research you have to do in order to kind of get the backstory behind those, or is that all in the archive?
So the archive pretty much just kind of has a description of what the photo, what's happening in the photo, typically just who's in the photo and the year it was taken. What we like to do is look back through our actual newspaper archives and look for the article that the photo first appeared, and then we'll kind of write a caption based off of kind of the photo information as well as whatever the reporter wrote way back when.
And so I've seen some of the captions you've done in, is it Spanish as well?
Yes, we've done that for our coronavirus account. We try to do some of the captions in Spanish. One of my colleagues, Gabby Fernandez, is fluent in Spanish. And for us, we see it as just a way to really connect with a lot of our readers. A lot of our readers speak Spanish, so being able to kind of provide that translation is something that's really important to us.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that coronavirus Instagram account. What was kind of the thinking behind spinning that out as a separate account rather than just running stories off the main LA account?
Yeah, when the pandemic really started to spread rapidly across California and the United States and even around the world, we saw that our audience was really looking for trustworthy news. And I think as a newsroom, we really prioritized that coverage, and we kind of wanted to elevate it the same way on social media. So by creating the pop-up account, we were really able to provide news about the virus from kind of all angles. We've incorporated stories from almost every desk on our newsroom on the account. So it's really been a team effort, and our readers have really responded well to the account. It's been up for about a few months, and we've gotten over 25,000 followers. It's been really great to see readers really engaging with us.
And I noticed for that, I know a lot of publishers will do sort of, you know, they'll do pretty pictures and things, but you tend to do this kind of headline style. It's like a headline and a picture, and then there's a bit more detail in the caption. Is that quite a deliberate design choice?
Yes, we've actually been really deliberate about that. One thing that we try to do on our social media accounts is making sure that the content that we present is really native to the platform. And when we look at how people consume news, specifically on Instagram, that's a format that people are really interested in and really used to consuming. We see a lot of these like meme accounts or kind of news accounts where it's pretty much just like, you know, a text over a photo. And that's just kind of the way that younger audiences in particular are used to engaging with news. So we try to kind of keep that same look and feel so that we can kind of hopefully get more followers and really get younger people to really engage with us.
Yeah, and kind of related to that, I noticed for a lot of the stuff the LA Times puts up, I mean, especially on Instagram where it's so much harder to link back, a lot of publishers will use social media in a way to kind of funnel people back to their website, but the stuff you work on seems to kind of deliberately be going away from that. It's like you said, you focus on engaging people on the platform. Is that a deliberate decision, or is that just because Instagram's really awkward with links?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely both. I think we've realized that Instagram is definitely a website where the users are not used to leaving the platform, whereas they would normally do that on Twitter or on Facebook, where they can easily click the link. We still provide a link in our bios for all of our accounts so that if readers want to read more, they have the option. But for us, especially on Instagram, our strategy has really just been engaging with readers on the site and just giving them as much information as they need there. And hopefully they'll kind of come to us as kind of that source of information when they need it.
So it's sort of wider brand building rather than specifically driving to stories or anything.
Yeah, definitely. And we've still seen a lot of success with Instagram stories and things where it's a bit easier to kind of go back to the website. So we kind of do a little bit of both.
And your work at the LA Times is as an audience engagement editor. So apart from all the Instagram feeds, what does that actually involve on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I, along with a few other colleagues, are on our core social team, which means that we're kind of responsible for the curation of our flagship LA Times account. So we focus specifically on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram. We have other editors on our team that work more closely with the specific desks in our newsroom. And then we have others who work more specifically on products like news aggregation or search engine optimization. So as a team, I think we're really able to kind of represent our audience to the newsroom and kind of really just kind of spread as much information as we can about our audience.
And do you have different kind of ways that you approach each platform? Like, have you got a Facebook strategy, a Twitter strategy? I mean, obviously the Instagram one is quite different.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, we definitely approach each platform a lot differently. I think just looking at the data and looking at what our readers are interested in, you kind of have to have a different strategy for each. But I think overall, our big focus is just making sure that we're providing our readers with the information that they need.
And that engagement part of your role, is there a mechanism by which you get that response from audiences? Like, do you, apart from obviously reading comments and things, are there ways that you pass that back into the publisher to inform a strategy or stories or what they do?
Yeah, one great thing I think about social media is that there's a lot of different metrics that you can use for success. So I think for us, we try not to just look at, you know, one thing. So for example, even with something like Instagram, we don't consider likes as the only kind of metric of success. We really try to be intentional about looking at a lot of different things on each platform. So our biggest thing is really looking at each platform holistically and driving kind of some conclusions based off of that. For example, with Instagram, I think a lot of people can really get caught up in, you know, how many likes a post has, is that successful? But there's a lot of other metrics that publishers could look at. They could look at things like comments. They could look at how many times the article was sent to a friend, how many times someone added the photo to their story, how many times they clicked the link. So there's just so many different ways that you can kind of define success on each platform. So just making sure that you're kind of intentional about knowing really how each platform works and how the data works is really important.
Do you do any kind of any responding to, you know, if people have got queries or questions on any of the platforms, do you as a team work on responding to any of that?
Yeah, as a team, we definitely try to do as much as we can kind of on all the platforms. I think one great thing about our website is that we're able to open comments. So we do have a pretty robust commenting system there. And we encourage our reporters to actually really hop in and interact with some of our readers. So we've seen a lot of great audience engagement there. On a lot of our accounts, we also try to answer questions. On our coronavirus account especially, people have a lot of questions about openings and different rules and regulations. So when we have the time, we definitely try to send as much information as we can.
I know a lot of people say that there's a darker side to social media as well. And people that are running the accounts often kind of see, I don't know necessarily abuse, but, you know, the trolling and the less pleasant side of things. Do you guys have a particular way you deal with that, or do you just kind of try and ignore people if they're being a bit stupid?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of hard, you know, we're kind of at the front lines of seeing kind of all the good and the bad of what people think about our content. I think for us, it is important to kind of, you know, look at the negative things as well, especially if it's feedback that we can pass on to teams in our newsroom. But I think overall for like, you know, the really kind of nasty comments, those are kind of things that we try to avoid.
And then as kind of the bigger picture, how does social media and audience engagement and the work you do kind of fit within the LA Times' wider, I don't know, has sort of big goals around this or things it particularly wants to achieve?
Yeah, one great thing I think about our audience team is that we're really able to touch a lot of things in the newsroom. Like I said before, we have audience editors who work on the desks. We have audience editors that work with SEO and that work with news aggregators. So I think it's really clear that our company values our audience. And as a team, we're really kind of devoted to delivering the best news product as we can to readers. So I see kind of the work that we do is really important and kind of really on the front lines of really looking out for our audience.
Yeah, I also noticed you'd started just by yourself a newsletter and website dedicated to journalism internships. I'd love to know a bit more about the thinking behind that and why that's particularly important to you.
Yeah, so I started the journalism internship site a few months ago. I think it was just kind of just me wanting to do more for students who were starting out in journalism. I think back to when I was in college, I noticed that there were just a lot of disparities in media, especially when it came to internships. And often a lot of the internships in media are unpaid or at least very low paid, which I think shuts out a lot of students, especially from low income backgrounds. And when I look at myself as a first generation college student, and even as a Black woman, I didn't really see myself represented as much in media. So I really wanted to try to collect a database of as many paid internships and really provide mentoring as well. Right now we have over 80 mentors who sign up to just mentor students on one-on-one sessions from a variety of backgrounds in journalism. We have reporters, we have editors, audience engagement, people, and people who work in product and engineering. So I think for me, it's just trying to play a small role in closing some of those gaps with representation in media.
Yeah, I mean, there must be a fair shortage at the moment anyway, because I can't imagine many places are offering physical internships, are they?
Yeah, not at all. Right now, it's been really difficult because we had so many summer internships for students to apply to, and a lot of those internships either got canceled or postponed or just moved online remotely. So we're really trying to figure out a way that we can still engage with students and kind of still get them that preparation that they need, which is why I think our mentorship program right now has been really useful, because even though a lot of students aren't able to intern right now, they can still talk to people in the industry and kind of get insights that they may have gotten during their internship.
And I know you do some work with lecturing as well, and I'm just kind of curious to see, there are so many students that kind of at the point that they're entering the workplace, and it feels like skills and things just change over so much. I mean, even 7 or 8 years ago, you know, an audience engagement editor wouldn't have been a role that they'd have looked at and seen. When it comes to kind of preparing students and talking to people that are coming into the industry about the skills they need, how do you approach that when things change so quickly?
Yeah, that's been definitely something that's been really tough. I teach at the University of Southern California, and there we are thinking kind of how to be kind of really agile when it comes to these changing industry norms and kind of the skills that students need to have. So I think for me, the biggest thing is just making sure that, you know, every semester you're kind of looking over the curriculum that you're teaching, making sure that it's up to date, making sure that the latest tools and the latest resources are involved. One way that helps me a lot is that I try to get as many speakers to teach to my classes as much as possible, just so that students are really getting an insight to what people in the industry are currently doing, how they got there, what tools they use day to day, so that they feel more prepared and more equipped to work in journalism.
Do you find that they tend to be quite, I don't say multi-skilled, but there's a bit of a stereotype that they know how to do all the social media and they know how to edit video and podcasts and stuff, or is there still actually quite a gap there in what they know?
Yeah, I think one great thing kind of about the next generation of journalists, as I like to call them, is that they are very skilled with a lot of these digital skills, and I think that that's one really great positive for them is that they're coming into this industry knowing how to do a lot of these things. And I think a lot of my classes right now are just really helping them to be able to refine those skills and really use them in the context of journalism. A lot of them may have experience using Facebook or Twitter or Instagram in a personal setting, but not in a professional setting. So I think what we're doing a lot of right now is less teaching of skills, but teaching more about how to refine those skills and how to really intentionally use them.
The last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read, watched, or listened to that really affected you?
Wow, that's a good question. I think the last thing that I read that affected me was definitely Ben Smith's column in the New York Times, just talking about social media policies right now, kind of in newsrooms, and this almost reckoning that a lot of newsrooms are dealing with right now when it comes to race and diversifying their staff. I find this conversation to just be really interesting right now, kind of seeing how newsrooms are demanding a lot more from their leadership and really wanting people to really make a concerted effort to diversify their newsroom. So it's been really kind of empowering to see so many people speaking out and really forcing real change.
Yeah, I never thought I'd see the day when so many publications would have so many top editors resign over this. And it seems we're kind of finally on the brink of actual change.
Yeah, I've never seen so many in such a quick time. So it's definitely interesting to see. And I definitely think that a lot of newsrooms are moving in a really good direction right now. So I'm definitely really hopeful about what the future holds for journalism.
So we're a couple months into our Media Voices Daily Media Roundup newsletter. If you want to sign up for that, you can get the top 3 to 4 media stories you need to know each day, plus a little line from us about why it's important and why it makes a difference to you in the industry. We also do guest editions every weekend. So again, if you go to voices.media and sign up for that, there's a nice little sidebar or a pop-up.
If you enjoyed this episode, or you get the daily newsletter and you love us for that, just want to show us your appreciation, you can buy us this virtual coffee on the coffee website.
Because nowhere that sells coffee is open.
Oh, my pub sells pints now. Takeaway pints.
I think we should change it to a pint. Anyway, there's a button on the website. Click on the button at voices.media or the banner that's in the newsletter. Go along and buy us a coffee and we will love you. Just like we love Fraser Allen, Thomas Bechdel, Sally Hampton, Colin Morrison, Jez Walters, Laura Jenner, Nikki Simpson and all of your anonymous coffee buyers. Thank you so, so much.
In the meantime, you can go to our website, which is voices.media, to check out our archive. It's like a time capsule, basically, now. All our transcriptions and sign up to our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on social by going to @MediaVoicesPod on Twitter. But until next week, when we're going to be back with a great guest and another, well, hopefully a cheerier roundup, even though we tried to be cheery this time. Thanks very much for listening and stay safe.
Bye.
Keep smiling.